Martin Short joined Second City in 1977. He was one of many Saturday Night Live cast members who got their start in improvised sketch comedy with Second City, but was one of the few to appear on both SCTV and Saturday Night Live. In fact, some of the characters Short made famous on SNL, like Ed Grimley, he first tried out on SCTV. One of Short's Second City characters was a rabbi who posed the question, "Why are Jews funny?" This was recorded at a Second City stage performance in Toronto.
Why are Jews so funny? I believe that there are two major reasons that we will list one and B. A. Comedians are generous people, and the generosity of Jews forever lightening and brightening the messengers of woe. I am reminded of the bum that walked up to the Jew on the street corner and asked him if he could have $5 until payday, at which the Jew asked, "But bum, when is payday?" At which the bum replied, "I don't know. You're the one who's working." "I don't know, you're the one who's working." And B, comedians are courageous people. And Julia has always stressed survival and true courage. I am reminded of the blind prostitute. You really had to hand it to her.
Martin Short recorded in the late 70s at a Second City performance in Toronto. On Saturday Night Live, in addition to doing Ed Grimley and Jackie Rogers Jr., Martin Short was also known for his impressions of Katharine Hepburn and Jerry Lewis. More recently, in his own show, Martin embodied the rotund celebrity talk show host Jiminy Glick for Comedy Central. In 1989, Martin Short told Terry that when he was growing up, there was a lot of comedy at home.
Comedy was very normal in our family. Do jokes was to be normal. Insult each other was normal. It was an Irish family that could have bursts of anger and then be gone in 1 second. It's very interesting. I have this like opening of Christmas gifts from 1966, a tape that I put on when I was a kid, and I heard it this year, you know, and I was amazed. It was like a mental family. It was like screaming and shouting and then laughing within the next second. No particular rhyme or reason to it. And so comedy was very normal.
Let's talk about Jackie Rogers Jr. A great character.
It's very, now let me say something about you. That you like Jackie is very revealing because, you know, there are two camps on Jackie. People either find him totally, I mean, just hate him.
Oh, really?
Or they love him.
Oh, I love him.
Like the cast at SCTV, most of them didn't like Jackie.
Really?
Yeah, they thought it was just kind of grotesque. And we'd write these pieces, we'd take them in the read-through, and they just kind of die, you know. But because the cast trusted me, they let me do it.
Well, I like Jackie because he's so extravagant and so show busy.
Yes, he's also the most self-absorbed
yes.
character that I've ever done.
He's a lounge singer for any of our listeners who don't know.
Who's also albino.
Yes.
And cross-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
His long white hair.
I think it's fair to say that one of his anthems is "She Loves Me."
Yes, it was his dad's song. You know, "She loves me, and my amazement, I love her. What the heck does that mean?"
That's a Sheldon Harnick song.
Yeah.
He also wrote the lyrics for Fiddler on the Roof, and
right.
This is from the show "She Loves Me." How did you? I think Jack Jones had the hit of it. How did you choose that song as the perfect showpiece for Jackie Rogers Sr. and Jr.?
I don't know. I used to go into the writer's office at SCTV, and I'd always be like, "She loves me under my amazement." And they'd say, "You should do a piece on that." And this is 1982, and I kind of said, "Well, I don't know if this is an old subject matter, you know, lounge singers." But then I thought that I would do a short piece, a two-minute piece, on this character, Jackie Rogers, And if I had him die at the end of the piece, then it would be no problem repeating Turf. So we wrote a piece called Jackie Rogers, Old Mother Nature, She Loves Me, which was supposedly something that had been done in 71, and Jackie Rogers had been killed while doing it. Whilst doing it, as Ed would say. And they were finally releasing it 11 years later.
We talked about some of the characters that you created for a sketch comedy. Let me ask you about one of the impressions that mm-hmm. you did, and that's of Jerry Lewis. I think you're really good at it because you know physical comedy and you can capture the kind of goofy aspects of Jerry Lewis, but you also get the kind of dark side, the bitter side, and the ego of the man. How do you rehearse to do him? What do you steady him before doing him?
I would start singing, "Gotta get my old tuxedo pressed. Got a smile, hold notes and shake." And I tell you what a joy and a thrill and all good stuff. You know, you just kind of... I would suck a lozenge, imaginary lozenge. I don't know why. It's not like he does a lozenge. But it's just an idea of, you know, an attitude. And sometimes you just hear people. It's like music. You know, you hear it and you just kind of get the placement... Yeah. In the voice or the throat and nasal, or Robin Williams, very kind of like that, you know, God, that happened, there's more back there, you know, so you just kind of play.
Now, I've read about you that when you were young, you used to do an imaginary TV show in your room that would run on alternate weeks in your imagination with the Andy Williams show.
Yes, that is very true, and we were canceled too, finally, which is a tragedy. Hullabaloo, I think, replaced us. Yes, I used to, it was 8:30 Mondays, in my mind.
Right.
And we'd tape ahead, you know, we'd have shows in the can, and I'd type things up for TV Guide, you know, highlights, Marty will sing, and I would come out, and I had a Frank Sinatra, The Sands album, so I used that as an applause record, and then... you know, I'd use intros from albums, you know, and I'd have a guest, you know, my guest would be Tony Bennett, and Tony would come out and say, "Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand." I'd sing another song, I just don't remember the words, you know, and he'd be my guest, and then I would, you know, sing with him, you know, with the record, and then I'd go to the applause, and I'd, you know, piece it together, reel to reel. And then I would take, you know, the Playboy of that month and do the interview with Eldridge Cleaver or something, and you know, I'd sit and you say that we're not moving fast, and you know, and I'd then read his part, and then I'd end with a medley, and then someone would call dinner, and we'd tape later.
Did you sit on a stool and sing like Perry and Andy used to?
Oh, sure, yeah. But sometimes I just throw that stool aside and belt out a big final.
Because that's the kind of informal guy you are.
There was no one restraining me.
So, who were your sponsors?
Bulova Watch was a biggie. And the Kraft people.
they did.
No cigarettes even then.
They did Perry Como.
Yeah. Kraft. Well, I know. They were very generous to help me out as well.
Why, if you were doing an imaginary show, would you have it alternate every other week with Andy Williams? Why not be on every other week?
How could I do my films?
Every week, I mean. What?
How could I do my films?
Oh, yes.
Remember,
yes,
I was directing as well.
No, when you were doing these shows, were they serious in your mind, or were they parodies of the show? I mean, were you doing them for real, or were...
No, it was real. I had a fantasy world that wouldn't quit, you know? I mean, I would... If I got on the back of a bus, I would go... If I got on a bus, I would go to the back of the bus, where the windows were kind of oval shaped, you know, so that it would, I'd have more of a sense of riding in a limousine. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and if I looked out the window, or I'd pretend I was, you know, on an airplane taxing off, and fans had, you know, this is a 10. I was just intrigued by it. It wasn't something, it wasn't like Rupert Pumpkin, or wasn't it?
Rupert Pumpkin, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that sick, you know, it was clearly a fun hobby. You know, it was fun, and while other kids my age were protesting, "You go to have a revolution," I was up in my room singing, "Weather-wise, it's such a cuckoo day," you know. But certainly I in no way did it become something that I, you know, would answer to two different names or anything.
Did your imaginary show have a theme? A song?
No, there would be a production number, you know, kind of opening, which would be similar, where dancers come out and go, "Marty, it's time for Marty." But, I mean, that wasn't a real theme.
Oh, what a nut.
Yeah. Sad, huh?
Terry Gross first interviewed Martin Short in 1989. When they spoke again 13 years later, they returned to the topic of his early showbiz fantasies.
So when you were young and you were watching all these TV shows and doing your imaginary show, did you have any training? Did your mother say, send this boy to acting school or give him singing lessons, develop that talent?
No. My mother was the concert mistress of the symphony. She was the first female concertmaster, actually. So I grew up with, at times during the season, 5 hours and of practice heard within the house on a violin. So the idea of rehearsal and opening night was not foreign. But no, I think growing up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, you don't instinctively, Broadway isn't down the street, so it all seems not terribly realistic. So it wasn't until I was in university and having done theater throughout university, realized that there was actually an acting scene in Toronto, Ontario, which was 40 miles away.
Did your mother measure talent according to more classical standards of rigorous studies and a more legit kind of singing voice than you probably had? You had a more pop voice.
No, you know what? It was very interesting. She was always very encouraging. In fact, when I was 15, Frank Sinatra had released an album called September of My Years. And I re-recorded that. I typed all the lyrics. And I had an attic bedroom, and the hallway to the bedroom was kind of had an echo to it. So I set up my chair. I had a microphone, reel-to-reel. And I would play the introductions from the Sinatra album. But it would be, of course, Frank was 53, and I was 14. But the introductions would be in his key, so it would be do 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 moon do 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 moon do 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 and here click strangers in the night. I was in Frank's keys, but I would do the album and it would take me about a week. I'd make up an album cover and then my mother, I remember, listened to it and critiqued it because she used to adjudicate at certain violin contests and things in her life. And so she wrote a synopsis a critique of each song, and this, the pitch was very good, lovely old song, well phrased at the end, hold the note too long here, and rated on a 4 stars, 3 stars, 3.5 stars, so I still have that.
Wait, was that helpful?
It was helpful. I think it was mainly helpful because someone was taking my fantasy world very seriously and treating it with credibility and respect. Frank Sinatra once said that his father was always around to piss on his dreams. And I think it's very important for parents to constantly nurture and support eclectic interests of their children, because you never know which one is going to become the fuel that drives their life.
Martin Short speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His work will be on the next collection of SCTV DVDs, which will be released next year. Dave Thomas, Catherine O'Hara, and Eugene Levy, along with John Candy, Rick Moranis, Joe Flaherty, and Andrea Martin, all appear on the 2 volumes of the classic SCTV series now available on DVD from Shout Factory.
I'm Yash Mengi.
And I'm Stan Schmengi. And tonight,
the Happy Wanderers salute composer John B.